Dr. Byron is where I tried on intimacy, like I tried on my mother's heels as a child, the shoes flopping about on my tiny feet, so much space to grow into. Dr. Byron, I have been driving around in circles for an hour, trying to run into Kwazi, I said. A flush of shame followed the words. What is it that you want from Kwazi, Sonia? She asked. I started to say, to screw, duh, when I caught my own lie and swallowed it mid-sentence. I wanted Kwazi to do the impossible. I wanted him to fill the hole. The empty in me was an entire planet, a solid celestial body insistent on being acknowledged. My sortilege did not summon Kwazi. It summoned only my acute awareness of the complete globe of nothingness, an impermeable mass that had taken up residence in the negative space where my mother used to live. Nothing could be done with the whole. But I drove in circles for an hour praying someone, not someone, Kwazi, would split the grieving world of me into manageable pieces. I want him to. The rest of the sentence was atomized in a planetary collision of mourning. My chest heaved as I bayed into the phone. I know, dear, I know. You miss your mommy. For 15 minutes, my therapist rocked me feather soft on the other end of a phone while I howled and cursed a world devoid of Terry. And as quickly as a blackjack dealer might flip the final card in a hand, laughter turned me over. How absurd I must have looked, menacing DC in the dark, stalking short black men. I must sound full-blown crazy. I have really been lurking around DC like a stalker tonight. And 2 seconds ago, I was in hysterics. Dr. Byron, I am losing it. No, you are not, Sonia. You are simply in this new moment. Grief was here. Now, in this moment, there is laughter. You can welcome both. In the first months without my mom, I was learning how to be with both, how to be with all of me, the whole. I ended my call with Dr. Byron and started up my car. I drove toward Baltimore. It was 9:45 p.m., time to go to bed. I looked down at the fuel gauge, slightly concerned. No worries. I would make it home. My gas tank was full.
Sonia Renee Taylor is a best-selling author and activist, and founder of The Body Is Not an Apology, a digital media and education company exploring the intersections of identity, healing, and social justice using the framework of radical self-love.
My journey, vulnerability, rage, and being Black in the art world. Written and read by Irene Antonia Diane Reis. I am a contemporary artist and visual activist, born and raised in Houston, Texas. My work is cathartic. Each series I create is a call and response for the memories I have experienced in my life. The journey of my work thematically brings my Black identity to the center stage. My Blackness is not linear. It is fluid. Being Black is multifaceted, and I want to show all of it. I want to continue to eliminate the normality of the one type of Black person that is showcased in white-centric art institutions. Interacting with my family archives became my sanctuary as a child. Reliving and rememory of the images allow me to heal. Later in my career, I was drawn back to my family archives, this time using them as a form of activism and celebration. Throughout this passage, I am giving you permission to see my emotions and experience what I experience. What I experience in these photographs is love, grief, rage, and joy. The art that has been created and showcased in this book is unending. It is forever growing with me, spiritually and physically. I imagine years from now, whenever I am physically unable to hold a camera or make art with my hands. I will go back to these bodies of work, much like my family albums, to find resolution for my everyday life and continue to heal. I was abroad in grad school when my father called to tell me his sister Yogi, my auntie, had died. Being alone, hearing my father's voice, and trying to be strong brought back old wounds of my granddaddy's, my father's father, passing when I was 9, and pulled me to my family archives repeatedly. I held on to this portrait that had my deceased loved ones in it, its warmth and vibrance offering me endless waves of comfort. Feelings of grief, memory, and love came falling in when I started to work with the materials. I covered my loved ones' faces with flowers at that moment, born of the pain of missing them and the tenderness of remembering them. I wanted to be able to express myself, this time as an adult versus when I was 9 and unable to. We were never taught to grieve, only to be sad and then never talk of the pain again. Whenever I have these moments to myself to listen and take in the photographs, I feel myself letting go of the pain of missing them and wishing they were here. Looking through archives has power. I believe it can be used as a form of activism and healing, particularly the picture in the center of my father's childhood birthday party. Throughout grad school, I found myself dealing with instructors, guest curators, and peers displaying pure ignorance toward that image. A lot of people thought I staged that photograph. I then was confronted with the reality that they had never seen a Black family portrayed with full-on Black joy. I remembered saying to them, "My goal is to break down the canon, the white gaze. I want to continue to make work for my communities only, so this is my way of doing so." People need to be exposed to these circulations of fluidity that Blackness holds. It should never be viewed as something linear. That obviously struck a nerve with them. I came off combative, but I was fighting to protect my family archives, to protect my Black identity. It's hard to unlearn whiteness when it's being pushed on you your whole life as a good thing, especially in art institutions and universities. For mainstream media, the imagery of Blackness has been controlled and contrived into how white folks view our community. I'm in control of my narrative, and I'm going to tell my story. My childhood consisted of dancing ballet flocorio and reciting poems of Langston Hughes to my father and mother while screaming, "I'm Black and I'm proud. I'm Mexican and I'm proud." My childhood was peculiar growing up in a biracial household. My mother is Mexican-American, my father is Black, and both grew up in small rural towns in Texas before they met in the middle of Houston. My father was very vocal about embracing Black identity. I saw myself being around groups and people that embraced my mother's features and culture instead of my father's, and this impacted my childhood. Due to my father uplifting my Afrocentric features and ideology, I found myself mirroring him when creating art with a heavy sprinkle of Black intersectional feminism. I often get asked why I haven't made art surrounding my Mexican culture or heritage. It's not that simple for me. The same way I was asked to choose between my identities growing up, I get berated in my adult life as an artist for not doing enough work about my Mexican side. What is it they want me to create? Latinidad doesn't celebrate or acknowledge Black or Indigenous Latinx folks, and based on my experience, I have to first make work about how Latinidad has impacted me. I have tried to separate the two identities, but it causes more harm than good, in my opinion. I refuse to make art under the false romanticization of Latinx culture. In talking about my experience of my Mexican side, my Black identity will always be a part of that, and that's the part they don't want. I continue to give them what they don't want. by speaking from my Black experience growing up around my Mexican family and friends from the Latinx community. We really don't talk about white supremacy and colonialism much with our family, especially on my mother's side. I was accustomed to masking my pain through my work. As a 27-year-old, I have recently made some reflections on the trauma that appears throughout the body of work Oculus Oculus, the reoccurring violence in the United States medical system towards Black lives, especially Black women and Black children being misdiagnosed. The photographs on the page represent a moment in time of me being vulnerable. I was diagnosed with a prolactin-known pituitary tumor at the age of 20, during my freshman year of college. I was told that I was born with this particular tumor. It first appeared with 5-hour nosebleeds, with me stopping up my nose with cardboard from the toilet rolls, and then hours of joint pain. My vision shifted. I needed glasses, but no one believed me. I was told time and time again I was seeking attention. By the time high school came around, I was defeated. I developed major symptoms, unbearable pain and lactation. I kept those a secret for 4 years because I didn't have the strength to defend myself, to be shot down for attention-seeking behavior once again. I found myself creating an art piece to make my voice heard. I experience pain. My pain is real. I am human. I matter. I matter. I started using the mixture of archives and the creation of my own photographs initially to find answers about myself, partially to heal. Digging in boxes, finding albums tucked away in closets, some that were tossed aside in the trash because they were building up mildew, as if they were meaningless. Remembering memories, remembering our history, holds joy and deep heaviness for my community. I look at this picture of my 91-year-old granny and me. She has done everything to shape me to be the beautiful Black woman that I am. I think of the generational love and resilience each picture holds in my family albums. As I continue this journey of working with my family archives to create acts of healing and to end generational trauma, I think about our past, the African diaspora, the erasure of us, the gestures I made restoring, circulating, and archiving them felt metaphorical, like bringing their souls back. I did it to protect not only the physicality, but the spirituality. I want my kin to know you exist. I promise I will never forget you. I will always love you even after you are gone. And I will continue your legacy of protecting our community through resilience, love, and rage.
Irene Antonia Diane Reese is a contemporary artist and visual activist. Reese is known for her image-based work revolving around the importance of circulating Black family archives. She continues to make work about unlearning white centrism in art, social issues, and community health.
Unlearning Shame and Remembering Love. Written and read by Yolo Akili Robinson. Sometimes I wake up and have to remind myself, there is nothing wrong with me. I have patterns to unlearn, new behaviors to embody, and wounds to heal. But there is nothing wrong with me in the core of who I am. I am unlearning generations of harm and remembering love. It takes time. I was so excited when Tarana approached me to write an essay. Not only was I honored, but as a wellness practitioner who has worked in Black communities for the past 15 years, I felt like I had so much insight to share. The night I started writing this essay, I just knew the words would fly through my fingers. I was ready to tell it all. How I saw forced gender socialization as a tool that creates shame. How I saw homophobia as the heart of male violence against women. How ableism and assumptions of normal keep us struggling with our differences. I was ready. But the moment I opened up my computer to start typing, I felt this sharp sensation pinch me in my gut. Something was not right. My first reaction was to try to push past the feeling. So I started to come up with a few academic terms, even wrote a few paragraphs that would make a sociology professor proud. But nothing landed. What I was offering was not embodied, and I felt the emptiness echo from the page. I kept asking myself, why? Why am I having so much difficulty with this? Why is writing about this so hard? Finally, after 2 nights of not arriving at a discernible draft, I gave in and decided to take a break. Almost immediately after I stopped, my internal shame narrative started rattling off in my head. Maybe I can't write because I need rest. Maybe it's COVID brain. Maybe I am not the person to write this and I have gotten in over my head. I decided to close my laptop. I will revisit this in the morning, I told myself. But before the light from my MacBook could fade, the tears started streaming from my eyes. I started sobbing. Snotty, mouth wide open sobs that prompted me, even alone in my apartment, to instinctively look around to ensure no one was seeing me ugly cry. I cried because I knew I was not ready to write about shame, and that I couldn't write about shame without writing about me. Shame is defined by Brené Brown as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love, belonging, and connection. Using this definition, I realize that I have never known who I am without shame. As a Black non-binary queer person born in America, I have never had the privilege of experiencing shame as just a feeling. I, like so many of us, was introduced to shame from birth as an intrapsychic and systemic reality. I was branded with shame by virtue of my Black skin, wide nose, and limp wrist. I was indoctrinated with shame from the history books to the media to my community's unanswered demands for justice. So in order to speak of my own shame and of shame and Blackness, I need you to first understand that through the lens of white supremacy, being Black is shame. And how we struggle to love ourselves and move through that shame is synonymous with how we battle white supremacy. One of my earliest memories of shame is from when I was 6. My father, who then served in the military and lived in Germany, had come to Fort Lauderdale to visit me, my sister, and my mother. We lived with my maternal grandmother, Lottie Mae Kyler. My father was tough and taut then. He is a Taurus. Muscles and shiny boots wrapped in the green and black camouflage of his military uniform. He came to Florida to find me, limp-wristed and light-footed, a Libra, hanging on the hem of my grandmother's dresses, enamored by her and the women who ran my life and what I saw as their everyday magic. He was not pleased. I believe he was worried for me, worried for my survival in the rough world we lived in as poor Black folks, worried that I would be destroyed, killed, ridiculed for my fairy-like nature. He was likely right. But whatever he felt at the time, what I felt from him towards me was disgust. I remember him looking down on me, his face scrunched up, the sun shining high behind him in the sky. He was clearly perturbed with my mannerisms and affect. I can hear him loud as day yelling at my mother. He needs to get from round all these goddamn women. What my father could not know was that those women, his wife, my aunts, and grandmother, were my everything. And when I heard him say these things, it made me feel ashamed for loving them, for desiring their wisdom and presence, for wanting to be like them because they were the only stable thing in my world. Too many of the men I knew were like him, in rage, disconnected, swirling tornadoes of unpredictable chaos. I understand his rage now as pain, his attempts to stifle my expression as caution. However, my little mind could not make those distinctions then. In the way many of our caregivers' voices do, some of his shame became my own internal voice, the voice that would never allow me to receive compliments because I didn't work hard enough, the voice that would not allow me to receive love because I was not good enough. Too soft, too wrong, too always around all those goddamn women. I hear the same thing from men, gay and straight, to this day. It is this shame voice that materializes through men in my life and has all too often made more sense than love and affection because it is more familiar. Shame untreated stifles love. Shame through the years has led me to excuse abuse and patterns of harm because I didn't believe I deserved much more. My interpretation of my father's actions and the shame I experienced with them pulled me continuously into reenacting that narrative. Shame unhealed is an intergenerational curse. How dare you not be strong? How dare you not be together? You should be ashamed. You have slept in bed for days. Black people are not this way. You don't get to be this way. How dare you be crazy, unkempt, reckless? How dare you not know all things? How dare you not be an unfeeling animal, unfazed by the woes of the world? Who told you that you had the right to be white? White supremacy shames us out of our humanity and programs us to shame one another at its service. The cotton field culture of slavery meant we were forced to push through, rain or shine, sickness or health, because failing to do so could mean the death of those we held dear. Like so many patterns from slavery, that pattern persists in Black mental health today. Researchers have called it John Henryism. The concept that we can and must push through to reach our objective, and that no pain matters in the process as long as we reach our goal. This attitude has real-life consequences. It impacts our ability to own our depression. It stigmatizes folks' experiences with psychosis and mania, linking with other legitimate fears of psychiatric care that Black folks have, creating a pungent mixture that prevents us from engaging interventions that can save our lives. In our communities, the historical shame about not keeping it together for white perception also manifests in the way we are trained to be respectable or die. Some part of the cultural Black psyche still remembers the core roots of this respectability. Put that face up and smile when that white man spits in your face. It is not safe to scream or attack him in anger. Hide your sister away when she screams out in the night, running from visions and monsters only her mind's eye can see. Don't you speak of mental illness. Don't you let them know she's touched. What they will do to her will be far worse than any danger the cotton fields can ever measure out. I don't want to hear no talk about mental conditions. Mental conditions are for humans. And since when have white folks let us be that? To be queer, trans, and Black is to know that when you are walking in Harlem, men will turn to look away from you, because to look at you is to see their shame. Their whole lives, it has been beaten into them that anything is better than being like you. Don't worry. You will get accustomed to the hurried rushes when you approach. You will learn to pretend you don't hear your cousin's side conversations about your sins. The words of Black women bustling by, whispering your existence is a waste, will wash past you on the streets and become as mundane as the smell of flour at the fish fry, as normal as the bodega cat climbing the shelves. It will pull together and prevent your wrists from relaxing, curb the twitch in your walk, or lead you to raise your jaw up so high to hold back the tears. Shame sits in the body and restricts the flow of love. For Black queer men and non-binary folks projected as men, gay culture is an ongoing competition to see who can shame whom first and with the most power. We are trained to seek out emotional intel on others, to exploit vulnerable and private moments. We are trained to dig into information about sexual prowess, dick size, ability to take dick, or if one has a dick. We are trained to scour the details to find a flaw, femininity, any opportunity to lift ourselves above one another and build a poisonous, patriarchal sense of self-esteem. Shame has also trained us to secrecy, because to thrive, we learn to lie at such an early age. You got sugar in your tank, boy? No, ma'am. You ain't gay or nothing, are you? Hell no. When you are raised to lie and hide to survive, if you are not careful, you will learn to lie and hide to live. In queer culture, these patterns of lying are so persistent that when you challenge them, people think you are being homophobic. We lie and hide to survive because we know that all too often, when we are seen, we are thrown away. We learn early on from our communities that our sexual expressions are not desired. Our bodies are not desired. Our patterns of loving are not what our loved ones want. This leads to both shame and an obsession with being wanted that contorts our ability to cultivate intimacy. So we try to gem the shame away, orgasm and ejaculate the shame away, church it away, smoke it away, meth it away, anything other than look at it directly and face its enormous power. Heterosexism, transphobia, and homophobia hold us hostage in a structural web of hate we conflate with community. Shame restricts the imagination and creates the illusion that it is culture. Surprise! White supremacy is not responsible. You are not poor because of systems. You are poor because you didn't pick enough cotton. Shame. Surprise! White supremacy is not responsible. Your friend is not dead because the system teaches men that trans lives are comical and disgusting. They are dead because you didn't do enough to protect them. Shame. Surprise! White supremacy is not responsible. Black folks are not distrustful of mental health because of the trauma they face within the system. They are distrusting because they don't respect that they are white folks' test subjects. Shame. Surprise! Black gay men don't have higher rates of HIV. Because the system never fully funded Black gay HIV/AIDS institutions. It's because Black gay men were confused to think that their lives mattered as much as white gay men's. Surprise, surprise, surprise. But is it surprising? Systems of white supremacy teach us shame because they have no guilt. Rejecting shame for Black lives means rejecting individual responsibility for structural failures. For too long, shame has been a central organizing force in Black communities. We have used shame to motivate people to go to church, to vote, to control women's bodies and sexual desires, to toss away our trans and gay children and take roles in institutions that tear our communities apart. To transform shame in our communities, we are going to have to weed it out. We are going to have to find a way to express our concern that doesn't equate to our noses in the air or our backs turned on our ugly. We are going to have to chant from the street corners to the halfway homes, from the ERs and the encampments, to the church pews and the house and ball competitions, to every Black life we come across. Shame is not your name. Shame is not my name. There is nothing wrong with you. There is nothing wrong with me. We have patterns to unlearn, new behaviors to embody, and wounds to heal. But there is nothing wrong with us and the core of who we are. We are unlearning generations of shame and remembering love. It takes time, and the time is now.
Yolo Akili Robinson is an award-winning writer, healing justice worker, yogi, and the founder and executive director of BEAM, Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. His work focuses on creating healing-centered Black communities. Hurt People, Hurt People by Laverne Cox. Read by L. Morgan Lee. I don't know how to leave my front door and not armor up. I'm becoming aware of just how automatic it is for me, and it makes me really sad because I would love to let it go. I had surgery earlier this year, and about 2 weeks afterward, I had to go to the pharmacy and pick up a prescription. This is in Hollywood. It was my first time leaving the house after surgery, and I couldn't walk fast. I felt vulnerable. It was scary because my way is to walk fast and to always look around me, hyper aware of my environment. Because I've been kicked on the street, I've been harassed, all kinds of shit has gone down. And that day, I was coming back from the pharmacy, wearing my mask and a visor, and this woman says, "Hey, sister, how you doing?" Oh, excuse me, I mean brother. And totally misgenders me, still today. This happened this year. I often associate the misgendering with danger because I don't know what's about to happen. And I was thinking, I can't run. I can't run now, I can't. I was so terribly scared. I'm 48. I'm famous Laverne Cox. And I'm still scared to leave the house. I'm scared of walking down the street because it's still not safe to be a Black trans woman just walking down the street. So the armor is real. My great-grandfather was a freedman in Alabama. One day, he was walking around Selma and saw this dead cow on the road. This would have been the early 1900s, I think. He took the dead cow home, cooked it to feed his family, and everybody got sick. But apparently, that dead cow belonged to some white people. The white people tracked down my great-grandfather and put him in jail for taking a dead cow off the road. And then once he was put in jail, that was a way to sell Black people back into slavery. They called it sharecropping, but it was forced labor. And so then he was sold out of jail into indentured servitude. My grandfather, J.P. Cox, was born on the plantation, where he was essentially kept a slave years after emancipation. He and my great-uncle Reuben didn't like to talk about it, but they were beaten to make them work. It was deeply traumatizing stuff. My grandfather was a son of a bitch. He beat my grandmother, he cheated on her, he was abusive to the kids. Some of my mother's brothers and sisters have a different memory of that, but my mother tells harrowing stories of domestic violence that my grandfather perpetrated. He had his affairs and never brought money home. The lights would be turned off. All kinds of really fucked up traumatic shit that my grandmother endured. That my mother endured. The compassionate part of me thinks, where were the tools for my grandfather to process having been beaten on the plantation? He passed his trauma along to his kids, and they were traumatized. And my mother, bless her heart, we've worked through a lot of this. She's 70 years old now, but my mother was emotionally abusive. She just was. What else did she know? How do we reckon with the story, as Brené says, not just of collective trauma, but of historic trauma? How it's not just passed down in our practice, but passed down in our genes. Violence is violence. Most of the people killing Black trans women are Black men. And I'm not saying this to demonize Black men. I don't want to participate in that. But it's the reality. Let's just talk about what's actually happening. The venom that I've experienced from some other Black folks has often felt like, oh, this is a disgrace to the race. That my transness as a Black person is a disgrace to the race. And that's some white people shit. That is the historic trauma of not the figurative, but the literal emasculation of Black men in America, something that we still need to unpack and heal from. When Black men were lynched, their genitals were often cut off, pickled, and sold. a literal emasculation of Black men. It happened. And then there's me, a Black trans woman, a person who's assigned male at birth. I've often felt the historic trauma of the emasculation of Black men that some Black folks have projected onto my identity as a trans woman. But my transness is not a result of white supremacist oppression. Trans people have always existed. There's just so much trauma so many of us don't know how to acknowledge, let alone cultivate resilience around. But if we don't talk about trauma, if we don't talk about shame and do the work to begin to heal, to develop shame and trauma resilience, we can't fully come together. I think many of us are in so much pain, so much hurt. What I've been trying to show is that that pain, that hurt, is intergenerational, it's historical, and it's collective. And hurt people hurt people. There is a lot of shame. Shaming people for their skin color, for their size, for the way they talk. Classism, colorism, misogyny, it's all intersecting. And so it piles up. The work must be to understand that these things are structural. And then we must begin to do the work to stop internalizing all of it. I didn't just solve my internalized transphobia 5 years ago, and now I'm good. It's something I still have to work through. It's something I work on every single day. My internalized racism and classism are issues I have to confront in various ways at various times. It's never comfortable. These things are so linked to trauma pathways and neural pathways in my body. These things are so deeply ingrained. Creating new, more resilient pathways, new ways of thinking and acting, takes consistent practice. I don't believe we can have conversations about racial justice or gender justice or class justice if we don't talk about shame and trauma. I don't think it's possible. It's actually necessary. Laverne Cox is a 4-time Emmy-nominated actress, an Emmy-winning documentary film producer, and a prominent equal rights advocate and public speaker. Her groundbreaking role in the critically acclaimed Netflix original series, Orange is the New Black, brought her to the attention of diverse audiences around the world.
Black Surrender Within the Ivory Tower by Jessica J. Williams. Writing is the place where I have allowed myself to become most vulnerable. From a computer, I type with my eyes closed and almost in a trance. I allow my words to come, sometimes despite my outlines, planning, and internal editing. I don't know what I feel until I read what I have written. The words that arrive are the ones that simply have to be heard. I surrender to them. Surrendering has become one of my favorite practices. In considering how to begin to tell a bit of my story, I had to return to the familiarity of my ritual to remember to trust my own process. Several now deleted drafts prior, I was too distracted by performing, allowing my mask to speak for me instead of trusting my own voice to narrate. After each draft, I convinced myself that the editors would read it and determine it was a mistake to have invited me to contribute. I feared not being good enough or being found out, somehow as if I had not earned the right to speak, or if I'm being truly honest, if I had not earned the right to be heard. Imposter syndrome grew into self-doubt. And my thoughts snowballed from, you aren't good enough to write this essay, to you aren't good enough to write any essay. I was shame spiraling, people pleasing, and most worrisome when I wrote I was performing for the white gaze and consumerism. Thinking of all the ways I would or could be applauded and praised for work I had yet to even complete. True to exactly what I research, fear, doubt, and cynicism were hindering my ability to be present. I had to tune out everything and every voice around me and remind myself that this work, like all of my work, was a try. It was, and I am, allowed to be and become without expectation. My practice of surrendering is the one I began to actively work on after I was sexually assaulted during graduate school in 2015. Having been trained as a therapist and 4 years into my leadership doctoral program, I knew I needed to ask for help immediately, but truly lacked the capacity to understand what my healing journey would look like. None of my training or knowledge eased the tightness in my chest or the tension in my jaw. It did not quell my night terrors or ebb the desire to pull my hair out. After 3 months of flashbacks, panic attacks, barely eating, and irritability, I exploded to my therapist, sobbing and asking him why I couldn't seem to shake it, frustrated that I was not proving to be the exception. He said to me, "Stop yelling over it and listen to it. What is your anxiety trying to tell you?" I had never considered that my anxiety was a voice. It would be years until I could recognize that voice as my own, but from that session, I began working on trying to hear my anxiety before it started to scream when it was still communicating at a whisper. I found that the only way to really hear it was to get still and listen, and the only way to get through my panic was to surrender. During the bitter work of healing from my sexual assault, I was able to address a lot of personal trauma. At first, I wanted to categorize the work as forgiving myself for not living up to the expectations of being an educated Black woman who could handle anything thrown at her and keep her cool. But truly, it was unlearning those expectations and accepting myself for who I am, as I am, that was my salvation. Audre Lorde said, "If I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crunched into other people's fantasies for me and eaten alive." In the time directly after my assault, that sentiment resonated so deeply that it became something of a mission statement. It was as if my anxiety was screaming no over and over again at the world, asserting that I would not be crushed under the weight of a narrative that I never chose. After my assault, I found myself opting out of performing femininity. I cut all my hair off. I stopped wearing perfume and makeup. I all but abandoned my love of fashion. I was less available. I no longer had the capacity for caretaking and nurturing that I had before. I became much more selfish and self-centered. I felt the pull from some around me to get over it, or at least not talk about it so much, when my inclination was to lean into my pain and speak openly about it. I wanted to be allowed to be a mess and in repair. So from the day after it happened, I kept a public blog and wrote, sometimes multiple times a day. I was finding my strength in ways that were foreign to me previously because I was listening to my own voice instead of the echoes of expectation. I learned that being an educated Black woman meant asking for help a lot, but most of all, it required me to completely redefine the idea of strength. In fact, I took the opportunity to redefine a lot of things. On a trip to Santa Fe to visit a former professor of mine, Rose, I sat in a parking lot of a grocery store and sobbed, telling her how I did not know if I could make it through the doctoral program. At the time, I felt not only overwhelmed by my PTSD, but completely uprooted. I genuinely felt as though I was losing my mind, and as someone who had been outperforming even my own expectations in graduate school before my assault, I was panicked as I saw it all slipping away. I could no longer juggle teaching and research and work. I could no longer be a social butterfly attending happy hours and networking events, volunteering at various community service organizations. I was constantly tired. I was irritable, often volatile. I felt like a time bomb, never knowing when a panic attack was going to come on so strong it would leave me unable to get off the floor for the rest of the day. I told Rose every fear I had for my career and my ability to rise to the occasion of my research, which was set to be deeply complex and personal. In this moment, I was truly emotionally bare with Rose, and her response was to tell me something that would stay with me for many days to come, including today. She told me, "Environmental factors matter a great deal in the ripening of grapes. If, for example, a grape does not get enough sunlight or gets too much light or warmth from the sun, it can cause the fruit to go into survival mode. Sometimes the effect is that grapes do not fully mature and balance the sweetness with the acidity, and they can be too much of one or the other. So the product is much more concentrated. Similarly, as our environmental factors around us grow extreme, we too go into survival mode. And this can greatly influence our ability to balance and can cause a sort of concentration of our own product. Jessica, right now you may not be able to produce a full-bodied Cabernet. Right now you may be a port. And that's okay, isn't it? In fact, it's wonderful. Allow yourself this moment. The idea that even when the world around me is chaotic, I could still produce and be essential and someone of value was a huge reframe for me. I would cling to the idea that beauty could be derived from pain in true alchemic form even before I could find the strength to live into the message. I was just back from anxiety and PTSD-induced disability leave on November 9th, 2016, when I learned that in this country, sexual violence and misogyny are not a deal breaker for many people. It felt like being assaulted all over again. "I can hurt you and get away with it." They were the words that Michelle Obama used in her audiobook of Becoming that so perfectly described what I felt as I watched men escape accountability from my own perpetrator to the nation's president. I cried for hours, unable to console myself. I played those words on a loop in my mind because they were exactly what had been echoing in my nightmares for months. "I can hurt you and get away with it." The horrific sentiment had been the reality of my assault and would continue to be as I moved through the world in a culture that had proved itself once again to not value an identity that I could not hide. How do I find my own value and my own worth in a world so determined to convince me of my disposability? In order to heal and reconcile who I was after feeling such layered violations, I had to do deep-rooted unlearning, relearning, and redefining. Sometimes, I've had to fight to see myself through uncolonized eyes. I've had to assure myself that I am not broken or discounted because of what happened to me or because others lack the metrics to appraise my value. To be Black in predominantly white spaces for the majority of your days often means affirming yourself, going without affirmation and representation for long stretches at a time. Aggressions like "I don't see color" or assumptions that educational achievement somehow offsets racism and sexism are laughable and offensive. We are intentionally robbed of opportunities to see the spectrum of who we can become. Without an accurate reflection, our world becomes a funhouse mirror of distorted expectations that we can never meet. More often than not, the people around me believe that they are doing me a favor by not acknowledging my differences. In South Africa, a common greeting is "Sawubona," which translates to "I see you," or "I acknowledge your existence." The response to this greeting is "Sikhona," which means I am here. When you see me, you bring me into existence. The more I think about it, the more it feels as though in every space I enter, I'm waiting for someone to exchange this pleasantry with, not just in word, but in intention. And usually I'm met with silence. What I've come to understand, though, is that most people lack the capacity because many have only been taught to notice whiteness. This white world of higher education was not designed to acknowledge me as I am, to value me and people who look like me. So often, the only way I am allowed to be seen there is when I perform and take on the traits of whiteness. I am heard when I speak articulately or dress professionally. I am allowed to exist, but just barely. The open neglect of my authentic being, authorized by someone else's poverty of consciousness. I started to use the same techniques of healing from my assault in reconciling my professional conflicts. Having grace for myself allowed me to be the Black woman and professor who openly admitted to my students that I was struggling with symptoms from anxiety and panic disorders and PTSD, and I invited self-care days into the syllabus as excused absences. I made a choice that if I believed in my own work, that authenticity and mutuality are keys to connection, then I had to combat the shame, doubt, and fear that held me hostage. I repeated the words of Brené Brown, echoing Audre Lorde, as though they were a meditation mantra. Shame is a tool of the oppressor. Shame is meant to evoke a trauma response. Shame is meant to produce fear and fight. I said them to myself as I fought my way through to get and stay present. I was adamant, even before I believed it, that I had nothing to be ashamed of because I did nothing to deserve what happened to me. Further, I was not responsible for other people's beliefs about me. I began to understand what it meant to move from a place where it was well within my own soul, and that was enough. Even as I began to heal and find acceptance within myself, it did not mean that my environment would always respond in kind. The dissonance my personal wellness journey would bring in toxic professional environments would be cacophonous. I was out sick from anxiety when my former supervisor called and asked me to resign. They claimed it was in our mutual best interest, but I knew it was because I pushed for accommodations for my health, and because, as a Black woman, no one thought I deserved them. I knew I was being asked to resign because prior to being out sick for my anxiety disorder, I'd met with many Black and Brown students, helping them advocate against racial mistreatment by faculty and administration. I knew it was because I was not a good soldier, as my supervisor once asked me to be. I had dared to define myself as something else. In a conversation with my uncle that will forever stick with me, I was explaining that I did not understand why I could not do what I'd seen others do and just press on, or at the very least, shut up more. After losing my job, I did not feel smart or capable, or like I could ever get back to a place where I could be proud of myself again. My uncle told me, in so many words, "This is exactly what you are supposed to be doing." He assured me that not everybody knows how to stand up for themselves. And sometimes when you draw boundaries, not everyone will like them or even agree to them, but you cannot make that your problem. God sent you on assignment here to be you. Don't let anybody else give you another assignment. I had to figure out how to manage the boundary of being authentic in an environment that did not always welcome variant truths. People do not like to be made to feel uncomfortable. Further, in American society, we go out of our way to avoid discomfort because we have little to no tolerance for experiencing pain. We constantly look for ways to self-soothe, self-medicate, or willfully remain ignorant to pain so that we do not introduce suffering into our awareness. We eat comfort foods. We drink to take the edge off. We pay entertainers millions of dollars to provide us with many respites from our own misery. So when I consider the hesitancy of others to ingest the reality of a Black woman, a fat, dark-skinned, queer Black woman with mental health disabilities to be exact, I am not surprised that there is no space or tolerance for my story. Do you know what the problem that has no name that Betty Friedan spoke of is for a Black woman? It's a primal scream in the middle of a garden party full of white people claiming to love that song. We have been singing our pain, painting our truth, dancing our joy, healing and nursing generations, and still, people act as though our plight is a mystery. Or at best, a subplot, and not a symptom of the bitter internal work that we all collectively avoid. As I healed and redefined, I also had to learn how to cultivate new communities and environments that allowed me to be seen and heard for who I was, and not just who someone needed me to be. I took a class called The Tao of Healing, and in it, we got to interview a group of survivalists, people who habitually prepare for the end of the world. They spoke about how they planned and what they anticipated and why they felt it important to be mindful of the myriad outcomes for the future. I cannot remember who asked the question, but from the class came an inquiry that shifted the way I considered not only the unknown, but also working through spaces from a place of vulnerability and uncertainty. As a survivalist, someone who is always preparing for the end of the world and training in how to survive unexpected outcomes, what do you need? Is it a tool? Is it water? Is it the perfect shelter? What would be the one thing, if you could think of it, that someone needs to survive the unknown? The survivalists barely hesitated before asserting, quite frankly, the thing you cannot do without is people you can trust. I cling to this wisdom more tightly than ever as I watch the world grow more and more uncertain, with nothing but unprecedented times ahead. I think to myself, I could lose everything all over again. My job, my home, people I love, none of it is promised, and all of it feels particularly temporary right now. Yet because of the mirrors, the people around me who constantly work to remind me not only of who I am, but that I am this sacred, reverent being, I have found myself resilient in the face of resistance. I continue to turn over the irony of being proud of my professional accomplishments and being complicit in a system of classism, exclusion, discrimination, and oppression. Being successful in higher education was and is very conflicting for me. Because in order to achieve, you have to become adept at assimilating. And despite your best efforts, you begin to internalize a culture of beliefs you never wanted or asked for in the first place. It is a sacrifice that you don't even realize you're making until you've made it. I find my peace in knowing that my presence within the academy changes the academy. I found myself determined not only to discover and lean into more of who I was as a Black woman, but to do so without shame in an open search of a community that would bring me into existence so long as I committed to being seen. Maybe you should teach people how to be uncomfortable. It was a thought that my dissertation chair once uttered to me during a meeting, and it has been ringing even louder as of late. At the time, it seemed like an utterly impossible task. How was I going to teach people how to be uncomfortable? Why would anyone trust me to do that? Now I can see that being a Black woman in my professional spaces is a leadership lab model for how to be uncomfortable. Surrender allowed me to stop fighting and listen. And listening allowed me the space I needed to hear the story being told and change it if I dared to. Having a strong community gave me the strength to continue speaking my truth, and working together, I could continue to face any unknown. It was never about what I had to obtain and always about recognizing what I carried innately. Dangerous is the woman who can give herself what she used to seek from others. Limitless is the woman who dares to name herself. The way I see it, shame cannot oppress what acceptance has already claimed for sovereignty.
Jessica J. Williams is a Black feminist artist and educator dedicated to the creation of authentic and empathetic relationships, communities, and organizations. Her work focuses on empowering individuals, centering the marginalized, in an effort to create inclusive and compassionate communities.
Steps to Being Whole, On Your Terms. Written and read by Aiko Bethea. Yes, I was the only one on this big-ass cheese wagon sent once a week to the white school for a gifted program. It had to be only about 20 minutes from my school, but it was a different world. Shinier. Cleaner. It's where I learned not only that I was poor, but about Black in relation to whiteness. I already knew I was Black, but it's something altogether different to be Black in relation to whiteness. Having a Japanese mother did nothing to disrupt how the world showed up for me and how I showed up in the world, Black and poor. What will she eat? There was a hushed conversation taking place among a few teachers and an administrator. I later realized that the school didn't have the free meal program. It wasn't a Title I school. They were trying to figure out what I would eat for lunch. The other kids had these cool lunch boxes with Capri Suns, fruit roll-ups, all of the pricey snack items that my mother never bought. We had to keep the lights on. It was embarrassing. No, it was shame. I wanted to hide. Why was I even there? The way I spoke was wrong. My too small clothes seemed to illuminate and yell, "Look at me!" My hair, just everything about me was wrong. Being Black here was wrong. Being poor here was wrong. I didn't belong. To be Black and a woman is to be drafted into targeted identity groups that often conflate classism, sexism, racism, genderism. This begins so early when you're the only Black child at a predominantly white school, the only Black child in a neighborhood, the only Black child on a sports team, on a street, in a store. You may become a wealthy and highly educated Black woman, but still, when you're seen as everything that a white supremacist society associates with being a Black woman: poor, uneducated, promiscuous, unattractive, sassy, loud. You walk into every room at a deficit. Unacceptable, unaccepted. When we're deemed unacceptable, our responses generally fall into four familiar patterns. 1, assimilate, striving for acceptance. 2, fight fire with fire, beating off rejection and judgment first and fighting shame with shame. 3, hide under the radar, invisible and unnoticed. Or 4, live wholeheartedly, recognizing white supremacy and deliberately making decisions that honor our values while leaning into connection, compassion, and courage. The first three options require us to armor up. Brené Brown defines our armor as the thoughts, emotions, and behaviors we apply to protect ourselves, particularly against feelings of uncertainty and vulnerability. Let's dive deeper into each. 1. Assimilating and striving for acceptance. When we strive to be accepted, when we seek to appease the system, we often use tools of white supremacy as our armor to gird ourselves against the shame imposed by white supremacy. This armor may help us to feel less vulnerable, less susceptible to attack, and more likely to be deemed acceptable and worthy. This armor affirms that we, as Black women, know how to behave and are not like the others. The more successful you are in assimilating, the more exceptional you are. You're less Black and more white, acceptable, worthy. Some examples of this type of armor: academic credentials, measured by the level of education completed and the elitism of schools attended. Professional titles, working at a respected employer or having an elevated role or title, such as manager, lawyer,